Do you still practice aerial skills?
Aerial silks, yes.
Aerial silks. Oh, fuck. I'm so sorry. Actually, I didn't know what this was. I did a YouTube search of your name, and I know you have embarrassing videos. I think you have a channel with like 4 videos or 3 videos.
I mean, mostly they are just videos that I upload for no reason for real. But like, there's one video, the only video, Aerial Silks one, which is something that I felt like.
No, I think there are 2 of them. One, I think, where you're giving this demonstration at Google.
I see.
I forget the name, but
Cirque du Google.
Yeah, precisely.
That was our showcase day. So everyone who was practicing at least some decent level, like they all had to do one song or dance or whatever they wanted to do as a final part of the showcase day. And there's a Cirque du Soleil is the name of a very, you know, amazing group out in the US that does something way more than that.
Okay.
And Cirque du Google was like a miniature, or supposed to be a miniature version of that. So that was me doing aerial silks at some point.
And I think there was another video where you were trying to do Rebecca split. Am I saying
that? Yes. Yeah.
Are you able to do the Rebecca split? I don't know.
I have not been on top of silks for a while now, but I can. The idea is you have A, strength, and B, flexibility. So I still do weight training. I still do yoga. I hope I can get back up again if I try to. But I haven't found the time to.
But how did
find
you?
Classes.
How did you even get into it? Like, it seems such a weird. I actually don't have. I have no friends who do aerial silks. Right, aerial silks.
Yeah.
I mean.
So it was very funny actually. I basically saw one of my co-workers. I think at the start of the conversation, I mentioned like all of us, we started off as software engineers, right? So another engineer friend of mine, I saw her perform for Cirque du Google the year prior. And the moment I saw her, I'm like, wow, this is such a beautiful thing to do. And
aerial
I would just,
silks,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and I just felt like, wow, I want to be there. Next day I show up in class. There are these. The good thing is there are free classes by Google.
Even aerial things like.
Yep.
Really.
So in a campus of around 20,000 people, I think they could manage to find only 10 crazy people who want to learn
I'm
this.
I'm surprised they even had. I thought like things like this, you would have to find some obscure street and you have to go to some teacher who. Like,
yeah. So I mean, normally that's what you have to do even here in Bangalore. Like there are not many classes.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, at that point, there were classes at Google in itself. So I show up to class next day and I can barely, you know, pick up my, barely hang for maybe 10 seconds in life without, I forget pull-ups, like I wasn't even close to it. Somehow from
so
there,
much strength, right? Like,
yeah,
seriously.
And I had none. I had basically never done weight ever in my life.
You have to do a lot
that.
Of weights for that, huh?
Yeah, so you do a lot of weight training, you do a lot of flexibility training. These are the 2 core things that are required. So, I mean, I started from absolute zero, like Kung Fu Panda said in his in that movie. But it was just so much fun that even the moments of practice were so rewarding. So I actually have tons of, you know, practice videos of me where I'm just getting tired, exhausted, dead, and hanging incorrectly. That was aerial silks.
Have you ever fallen? Like, I thought, I kind of feel like it's a bit dangerous, no? Like, I mean, when you're trying to, like, get yourself in that position, sometimes you lose focus. There's
absolutely, I have.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the time when my mom truly got angry. So I fell literally on my head.
Oh.
This was
neck
after,
issues and all that.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was after 1.5 hours of the class, and I think I was just tired. And the thing about when you're new at this, even if you start gaining strength, you're a bad judge of your own strength.
Mm-hmm.
So I was super tired by the end of it, and we were doing back flips and front flips. So I think at one point, after a number of flips, I basically couldn't do the full 360 degree, and I fell 180 degree on my head. I remember that evening really well because I couldn't find like an ER in emergency room in the Bay Area, which would, you know, see me. I was fine, like I was moving. I had some inflammation, But it's not like I had.
But generally,
you know,
the pain starts the next day, no? I mean,
exactly.
You won't feel it then.
And forget the pain. Like, there is a real risk of paralysis. Because you can be paralyzed for the rest of your life, something,
I mean,
like that.
Neck issues are really, I mean, yeah. I never, like, so I do some jiu-jitsu training, and even during that time, there's a lot of throwing you around and neck locks and all that. So while, when it comes to the neck, right, I'm really like, bro, like, take it easy, like, calm down. So, yeah. But one thing, which I really, I saw the Google is, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that video. I was really impressed with your full split, though.
Oh, okay.
I've been trying to get the full split for some time now, and you were doing an aerial full split, I think.
Yeah.
That was truly amazing.
Thank you.
But are you able to do it now? Like, I know that people who can do
mm-hmm.
like a full split then or whenever, they tend to lose that ability later on.
It is definitely something that you have to carry on for the rest of your life, like, as in flexibility. The good thing is, I'm just all my life I've carried forward running. The only times when I'm not running is when I'm injured, which is also decently frequently enough.
You're like a fitness freak, right?
I just like to, yeah, I think I wouldn't call myself a fitness freak, because I don't think I've done, you know, I don't know, a marathon or anything of that sort. But yes, I do care about fitness. I'll just say I care about fitness. I care about.
You work out every day?
5 to 6 days a week. So not every day.
And most of it, is it running or?
It's a mix, actually. Sometimes running, sometimes weight training, sometimes sometimes it's a mix, actually. So for example, I would start with weight training, then I would end it with 15-20 minutes of cardio, and then at the end of it, yoga. So stuff like that. So it has to be a full package in some sense.
So,
and
so there's this podcast called the Huberman Lab. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I haven't.
I'll WhatsApp the link to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, actually. So he suggests a lot of these weight training routines. Not only weight training, but like he's this neuroscience professor at Stanford, and he recommends a lot of not only physical fitness protocols, but also mental protocols, and getting sunlight early in the morning to get your circadian rhythms in place or whatever. I don't know, man. But it changed my life, actually. So some of the things that I've been following are pretty.
I'd love to.
Yeah. So that was with the aerial silks. I was going through your bio in, I think, Lightspeed itself.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read some of it. A daughter of immigrants in India and the first girl in her community to have a job. She started her career she started a career as an engineer at Google in Silicon Valley. So here, I had to pause for a second in the sense that I initially thought you were kind of born in the US, because, you know, generally when we hear things like immigrant parents, you don't really think of India, at least I don't. I don't have, again, like I said, I don't have any friends who did aerial silks, and nor do I have friends whose parents are immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
What is kind of the impact? I mean, were you conscious while growing up of the thought that you had immigrant parents, and did that kind of factor in the way you were kind of brought up?
I think there was always, the way these things work, honestly, is very subconscious. I think on an everyday basis, it's not like you're consciously thinking of something different, but it would just show up in multiple different ways. The good thing is we're not super far from the culture here, but just maybe an slightly more extreme form of it.
You immigrated from? Your parents immigrated from?
So, I mean, I want to tell everyone about that.
Oh,
but
okay.
Like
okay. No, fair enough.
Yeah. But my point is that I think it basically shows up in, you know, how you work, like that emotion of working really hard and proving yourself, that emotion of, the way forward not being obvious. I think that sort of is what it means to be, you know, daughters or sons of immigrants.
Like starting from scratch, per se. Is it something
yeah,
like
starting
that?
From scratch is a very good way to put it. When you know you just have to build everything from scratch, you don't really quite have systems around you built. And I think honestly that still shows up in till this date in my work, in the way I carry myself, in the way I do everything else. It's a lot of it is self-driven, and I think that sort of carries on.
But you're attributing this to the immigrant story itself, or is that or
I think, as I said, right, I think it's a lot of these subconscious things. I don't think you do it as very, you know, knowing that, I don't think it works like, oh, I'm a son or a daughter of an immigrant here, and so I need to do more. But it works very subconsciously when you see things around yourself being built from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, as I said, right, a lot of my friends would actually agree and relate to the motion. I think a lot of, especially now in the startup ecosystem, I think a lot of founders have basically come from these middle class parents and middle class everything, right? And so you see everything being built with a lot of hard work from scratch. So I think that shows up when you do something.
I mean, middle class, I mean, the thing about, I mean, obviously the middle class story is, at least the way I look at it, middle class story is a different story, but immigrant story, I mean, first of all, in India, you don't get to hear the immigrant story at all because,
there are not many that broke out.
At least I think in this may be my own ignorance in the sense that I think in South India you don't get to see a lot of at least stories. I think in North India, because of the partition,
exactly,
you do have a lot of immigrant kind of families moving into, I think, Delhi,
right,
and that Punjab region per se.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
in South India, very rarely do you come across, I mean, army and all, you get to hear, you know, my dad's in the army and we do a lot of posting throughout the country, but you know, coming from a different country per se, very rarely do I get, at least me personally, very rarely do I get to encounter. And even in pop culture in India, again, contrasting this to the US, right? In the US, you have a very vibrant, like, you know, immigration story.
Right.
Kids also have this huge, what is that? You know, I'm an immigrant, and, you know, they find their own clan, and, you know, they try to stand out from the culture as well. In India, not so much. I mean, you know, people just take it for granted that, you know, she's brown skinned or I'm brown skinned, and obviously we're Indian, so
that's
not
very
much.
True. That's very true. There's a physical divide, I guess, in a lot of cases in the US, for example, but not 100% there in a lot of other cases. Like, for example, the founders of Google, one of them was, you know, son of Russian immigrants and things like that.
Right.
So for sure there is an element of just looking different that maybe amplifies that emotion. But I think honestly, right, if you ask me, the difference is that the immigrant community there has is the one that has sort of built a lot of the tech ecosystem and other things that we hear about every day. So it might be like sample set bias. I feel like the immigrant community here is a lot more subdued and hasn't quite broken out in those sort of ways which we look at.
That might be one reason. But also one more, I think you kind of alluded to this in the sample bias, in the sense, I mean, the immigrant community there is very selective, right? I mean,
yeah,
in the sense that they generally take the smartest and the...
True, exactly.
You know, if you are taking the cream of IIT Bombay, IIT Madras,
yeah,
and then, or whatever colleges you have, and... you're kind of giving them that opportunity, then obviously that they are bound to kind of stand out from.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's actually studies about this on how in the 70s and 80s, when immigration to the US was super high, that has sort of led to all the industries and things we see now. So there are actual cases about
that. I mean,
that.
If you just step back, it's crazy, right? I mean, what is that? I think Microsoft CEO is, I think...
An Indian?
Indian, yeah. He was not born there, right? Yeah, he was not born there, yeah. But he's an Indian origin, and... Google,
of course. Yeah.
Those are the only two I can think of for now, but I think there are multiple cases.
There are multiple.
I was
Vimeo
watching
recently, Vimeo CEO. She is Anjali.
Yeah.
Anjali CEO.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, Parag, CEO of Twitter. Ex-CEO of Twitter.
That didn't turn out really well. That wasn't
yeah,
the proudest Indian moment, I think.
Yeah.
But I was watching one of your other GCP, Google Cloud videos as well. And then you were the product manager. And I think the lead software engineer was also an Indian, I think. Pavitra, her name was.
Yeah.
Pavitra and Manjot. I was like, bro, are Indians running the whole thing? Like, seriously, man. Something to take pride in. But also, you know, it's curious that we have not been able to kind of develop that in-house, you know what I'm saying, in India per se. I mean, we've not kind of...
Attracted the right, the cream of the cream immigrants, like the US has become an immigration powerhouse.
Not only that, I mean, I'm just thinking, we've not even been able to, where you see Indians running a major multinational companies in the US, Indians themselves have not been able to build like global tech companies or global brands or... done like something significant in the business world. That's an extreme statement, but you know, you don't get to see native Indian companies doing extremely well in international markets, whereas Indians themselves are doing pretty well once they leave the country per se.
I actually, I think you're, you know, it's an evolving ecosystem. I think we're seeing the very first wave of international companies and brands being created from India and by Indians living here versus, you know, migrating to the US. Obvious examples of that, like Byju's, for example, has broken out and is now selling to multiple countries. Zomato tried to do that.
Byju's even in Western countries, or is it only South Asia?
Western countries, there are products, for example, that have now started breaking out. SaaS is an obvious example of that. So within SaaS, for example, Innovacer is a company that is, you know, mostly selling to the US. Freshworks is one of the biggest examples, of course. In fact, within SaaS, you'll notice the exact opposite, where most of the larger outcomes are basically selling to the US and other nations. Going back to your question, right, where you say Indians haven't been able to create these major global brands, I think we're now seeing the first wave of that actually happening. And I think the reason for that is a few things have been unlocked recently. One is just on the talent side of things. India was always an engineering powerhouse. There was no doubt that there were lots of great engineers being minted. Obviously, a lot of them moved, but even then, you know, I think we always had the engineering talent. Over the past, I don't know, 4 to 5 years, I would say we've had the product talent. And this also shows up in our consumer products.
By product talent, you mean just identifying good products, like what products to build for the global market, is it?
Yeah, every global or domestic, both. When I say product, I mean exactly like what to build, how should it look, how should the experience be. When you look at, you know, one of the consumer products built out of here, such as Zomato and Swiggy and other such things, like you do experience a world-class product, just like you would in the US. So I do feel that we now have the product talent to build, you know, the right sort of products here. We're just getting started on that front for enterprise and SaaS products. We now are in that place where we have engineering and product talent. We might not have the go-to-market talent to really make it super large. And I think that's the muscle that we're trying to build right now, the go-to-market talent, which is exactly what will accelerate companies from just, you know, being smallish players in the world to like category creators and category leaders. Examples of that can be, one upcoming company, I would say, is Axel Data. So it's an enterprise tech company, which is, a category creator, but also category leader globally. Started from here, ex-Hortonworks founders, identified the right niche. So as I said, they had that product muscle and are now building that go-to-market muscle. Founders are already in the US, building out their teams and everything else. So I think that's one example of, you know, one company that has broken out. Another example can be Hasura. Leaders in providing GraphQL as a backend. So that's what I said. I think we're now
These are enterprise companies, is it?
Enterprise companies, yeah. I mean, with respect to consumer, there's, I think Quizzes is one company that has gained a lot of traction in the US. Byju's, as I already mentioned, there are other products that are trying to gain. But yes, I mean, as I said, very few examples right now that hopefully we'll see accelerate over the next couple of years.
Do you feel like this is like the 90s moment for us, in the sense that in the 90s, at least in the US, where a lot of consumer companies, 90s and I think early 2000s, where a lot of US consumer/enterprise companies, started to develop. And I think even their startup ecosystem, like a lot of VCs funding money, expertise was being developed by people who had founded companies earlier. Do you think we are at that stage, or is that, do you think, many people say that we always try to fit the Western template to Indian problems, and that's not the way, and that's what I'm doing right now, where I'm going to the US 90s. Do you think that's not even the way to look at it, or how do you kind of
I think all those eras are very, very different from each other. 90s US, this is pre-internet era, so all the funding, this is also the time when the venture ecosystem technically got started in 1965 to 1970. And mid-80s is when the venture ecosystem itself was accelerated. That's the sort of spurt we saw in the 90s, when we saw pre-internet era companies sort of come, Yahoo, the likes of Yahoo, etc. Google also started in 1998, so closer to the end of that decade. 2000s, I think, was like, you know, post the crash. So all the hopes and highs of the internet era were sort of coming down. And that's when, you know, we noticed the next cohort of great companies being built out. I think given every sort of downturn, you see these great companies being built out, where founders that truly just want to build come and, you know, hire the best talent which is available. Capital is obviously, you know, not as freely available as was in the past, but then that also helps you in a way if you're focused on the fundamentals. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, you can't quite compare the eras of the 90s and 2000s to the era in India. India is a very different ecosystem. If you notice, even if you're in, I would say even different from China, which is more closely compared to, right? So for example, in, you know, the time when Flipkart was started, early 2010, 2011, that sort of era, like barely any VC funding in India, barely any ideas being, you know, funded. So I think they, if I'm not wrong, they raised their Series A from Tiger itself. And they sort of found about Flipkart through Google searches. If I'm not wrong, that's the story. So yeah, it was that sort of an era where capital was really not as freely available. Not many people were starting up companies. In fact, it was unheard of. 2012 is when I started working. At that point, that was definitely the normal thing to do and not the popular thing. Now, I think the popular thing is by far being a founder. 2015, India growth story was, I think, the first year when we saw a huge amount of capital being pumped. I mean, of course, if you look at the numbers now, the numbers then will look small. But at least at that point, it was one of the largest infusions of capital.
2015, is it?
Yeah. And that is one era when I think a lot of founders definitely came out, started up, and 2016 with the downturn.
Any theories on why 2015? Because I would assume it would be, if you'd have said 2016, 2017, I could kind of fit my geo model, and, you know, geo was released around 2016, 2017. Any theories on why 2015?
I mean, 2015, Jio actually got started earlier, right? And that's when the theory
was... Oh, but you're
exactly,
attributing it to Jio itself, is it?
Yeah, I mean, Jio is definitely like a benchmark in the Indian story, right? That is what unlocked data availability to a huge part of the population. And
I think
that's
opened up about, 400 million people to internet,
yeah.
Or more than that, I don't know.
Yeah, so it was basically a huge number of the Indian population that basically got data for the first time. And I think that truly was an unblock in the India internet story, so which led to the funding of a lot of these consumer companies back then. And of course, with every, I think it's a cyclical thing in the world where everything that goes up comes down. And 2016 was the year when we saw that funding sort of dry up a little bit. But I think, you know, as I said, in every cycle of upturn and downturn, the stronger ones, survival of the fittest, the stronger ones remain. And so even from that era, we've seen, you know, a few great companies being created, such as Urban Company was one of them, Urban Clap, as it was called in 2015. Now I think the era that we are entering, right, we've been through a few cycles. Even the 2020, 2021, 2022 early era that Indian startup ecosystem went through was very similar to the one that happened in the US, which is, you know, tons and tons of capital being sprayed across multiple. That
in
was
2021,
2022, you know, tons of capital being sprayed, ridiculous sort of valuations at every stage. I mean, I think this is exactly the same thing that happened in the US. I would only say that in the US it was even more amplified.
Right.
So obviously India is always like a miniature version of that.
Right.
But I think now that that cycle has come down, that cycle has also come down in India. So now we're experiencing the third wave in some senses of, you know, building. So I'm very excited personally on how this particular phase turns out to be. There are, I think, as I said, right, now we have some great amount of talent here. There was always cost arbitrage, but I think now it's more about talent and talent quality and product quality. I think now we are starting to learn how to unblock playbooks of go-to-market, which is very critical in SaaS. I think in general, there's lots of optimism around SaaS and for very good reason. Very good reason because... some of these reasons I summarize in a blog post that I wrote a while back. One is just, as I said, the raw talent here has you know, always been a strength to build some of these products. B, I think we finally started facing problems of scale in some of the consumer companies that we've had here. So, you know, when you see an engineer or product manager in one of these large consumer companies such as Swiggy or Flipkart, they go Hotstar, like they go through a lot of these infrastructure problems, right? And they notice organizational problems and how we can solve them with software. That's when they get ideas about, okay, well, this is what we are supposed to be building. So that's, I think, another reason. Third is, I think people finally have seen some success stories. These success stories are the ones that motivate people that, hey, you know what, like a world-class company can be created out of here. Whether, you know, you think of Hasura, whether you think of Freshworks, whether you think of Chargebee, like all the great, you know, companies that Zoho, of course, is a big example. So when you first see success of like a very truly native company being built from here and browser stack and going global from day zero, I think that gives you a lot of optimism that
right.
there is a playbook that can be used, that can be established and things like that. And of course, capital, I think, helps. I think the Indian ecosystem now has, you know, I mean, we're obviously one of the venture firms looking for great founders and great teams targeting large markets. But I think there's a lot of capital in the ecosystem as well, which I think always helps with innovation.
I mean, just looking at when you mentioned, you know, seeing other companies succeed or looking at great companies being built in native in India. For me, if I can colloquialize that example, it's like watching your friend succeed and, you know, trying. You get the idea that, oh, if he can do it, maybe even I can do it.
Hmm.
So I feel that's very important in the sense that if you only see, like, I don't know, if you're only seeing like Western companies or US companies, US-based companies, you're kind of bound to at least have that artificial limit that, you know, company, if you want to build a company, you have to go to Silicon Valley or, you know, only US founders build like global companies.
Right.
But I think when you see a lot of success being, a lot of money being made by you know, by people in India or by people who have started companies in India. I think you also, if not out of like you know, public welfare, at least out of greed. I think you're smiling, but at least out of greed, I think people you know, will end up figuring out how to, you know, at least start companies and all that.
Right.
And I think Bezos is a clear example, right? I mean, he was not, I mean, I think he saw that the internet was growing at X number of percent and just jumped in.
He was a hedge fund guy, I think, and completely out of the, well, I mean, somewhat out of the tech ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I mean,
saw an opportunity.
That's not like a story of where he had this amazing idea and just kept, I mean, it was a very calculated move. I mean, you can't, I mean, that passionate founder, I mean, obviously this passion, but very calculated businessman types, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like a tycoon type.
Yeah.
Turned out pretty well for him, actually. On the Hotstar, I mean, on the infrastructure you're talking about, I mean, Hotstar apparently deals sometimes with like 60 million people. What is that? Sorry, not 60 million. I'm not.
At peak,
I mean,
for IPL and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't even think Western services have like Western services see that kind of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So in
Absolutely.
In terms of like, I think traffic and all that, I think India's what the market is in terms of that, it's pretty unique, right?
In fact, so somewhere in, I don't remember the year exactly, was it 2015 or 16, somewhere around that year is when basically Google and YouTube as an organization started noticing India a lot, because what they saw one day when they woke up was suddenly that graph went up of the number of views, and they were very confused as to why the graph is up.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out India, a lot of people in India had just come online and started watching tons and tons of YouTube videos.
Because of the geo.
Yeah. Okay. And so for sure, to come back to your point about traffic, right? I think now with the numbers that we have, for sure, the numbers that we have require that massive scale support, which we did not even have as a problem in the past. And I think that is what I meant when I said, you know, if you as an engineer experience these pain points inside an organization and see that scale, there's a certain level of infrastructure that needs to exist. Facebook, they created in the early growth years their own database systems. One is Cassandra, you know, another one is Rockset. We do this series called Dataverse. where we host speakers. We had the founder and CEO of Rockset, Venkat, speak on one of them last week. And, you know, they basically created all this infrastructure themselves just to support their inner use cases. And, of course, then they open sourced it, and that's how it grew. Then the founders of that open source repository came out and started companies around it. I think another interesting fact to take note of right now is India, GitHub announced India has 10 million developers. And most of the open source contribution, I think second highest open source contribution is coming from India right now, if I'm not wrong. So that basically tells you, right, this is how your infra and enterprise ecosystem evolves over time. So now we're seeing the first signs of, hey, there is something promising here. There might not be, you know, comparable number of startups, enterprises, and products yet, but the foundation is here.
Mm-hmm.
Since the foundation is here, that's what makes me very excited in my job on, hey, what's next for India and enterprise tech?
Your first love is infra or venture? Like, not first love, in the sense like, you know, that true love.
I mean, I've mixed the two, so I'm basically combining them. No, but you know, as you might have seen, I basically started as technically an SRE at Google.
No, but your venture history is too good, man. I'm really impressed. I was so impressed. So did you like have to... And you've been doing this only for a year or so, right?
Yeah.
So did you mug up? Like, I mean, not mug up, but did you go through like history of venture and all that while prepping for the role? Or?
Oh, no. Oh,
or were you always...
It's just these are fun things I would do in general in life. I read a lot. You know, I try to learn new things. It's just a part of my... These are things I learned from random books here and there.
Really?
yeah.
Because as a developer, would you get a lot of time to, I mean,
mm-hmm.
so when you're working as a developer, I mean, after your work, and this is my observation, you generally want to do something completely different from, you
mm-hmm.
know, you don't want to... I don't want to make generalization, but I don't know, man. Generally, I would assume that people wouldn't want to code after they've coded like 10 hours a day. You
right.
know, they would want to do something else. So you would be
mm-hmm.
like going through venture magazines, is it? Because the history's too good, man. Like, I'm seeing this. I'm really...
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, different things that I try to learn at different points in time. So, for example, at one point, I would pick up 3 or 4psychology books about persuasion, about game theory, you know, how to psychology of kids. Like, I would pick up themes and read 2-3 books in one go to learn something about it. Or I would pick up something in, you know, how to increase your lifespan. So I would pick up biology books. and so it's a bunch of random books that I pick up and try to learn from. I think a few things that I learned back then when I was an engineer. Once I picked up a Harvard Law course. So I was doing
that
for a few
months.
Yeah.
I think we've all
months.
Done that.
Yeah. And once I was learning how to reason and argue, that was the name of the course, I think. So it is just a bunch of random things that I learned. Once upon a time, it was about venture and the venture industry.
Mm-hmm.
I think recently I read this book called Power Law, which is pretty good.
Power Law, is it?
Yeah. So it's about the venture ecosystem and how that evolved over the ages. And I think the reason why I read this book in particular you know, it's one of those things where I think there is genuinely a lot of learning that can come from history. And unless you understand and learn that historical perspective, you will not be able to understand maybe some of those cycles repeat. And you'll be better able to see those, you know, cycles repeating, especially in venture. So yeah, that was the motivation for reading that particular book. And I mean, it's just a very fun read.
But it seems like, I mean, if that's the thesis, I don't think these venture people are reading a lot of history because of the things that repeat themselves in cycles.
Maybe it's not a repeating cycle right now. So for example, recently there was a very good memo by Howard Marks. Called Sea Change. Definitely, you know, tell people to read that. That basically talks about how this particular time frame of 2023 and post is fundamentally different from the last 40 to 50 years of growth we've had. That's why he literally called his memo Sea Change. I think that one is a really great article. I would highly recommend reading that.
Okay. I'll put the link to it in the description. So I don't think you'll answer this, but anyways, I have to ask this.
Yes.
Which is, so will you have kids?
I would want to, yeah. I mean, but why wouldn't I answer this question?
I mean, I thought you wouldn't. You know, I make certain assumptions about the guest, and you know, I kind of, yeah. I want to probe that, but anyways, let me just move on. China. We were talking about great companies. I mean, China has this very... I hate the Chinese model in the sense that even though they've been extremely successful, the thing that I don't like is that their companies get to compete globally, but like Western companies or like country or companies from different countries are not... Like they have, at least tech, I think. Yeah. I mean, general commodity companies, I think they do allow to compete in their markets, but I think in tech in general, they don't allow, and due to which... extremely successful companies like Tencent and I think Alibaba have been purely global success stories. General thoughts on Chinese tech or country or the way their work ethic is, I think, very famous as well. I think 996 or something like that. Thoughts on China in general, do you have any?
I mean, actually, first, even before thoughts on China, one thing I'll say is slightly contradicting what you just said on this model of, you know, being protectionist and not allowing American firms compete in the local economy. That's actually not a new model. There have been historical accounts of lots of different countries trying to do exactly that. And even till this day, are trying to do something like that, which is basically a local domestic you know, enterprise protectionist sort of policy. So for example, in 1800s, Germany had some of these policies around devices. And again, I can't recall, I'm forgetting that book, but I definitely read somewhere that there are a bunch of these other countries that had similar sort of policies.
No,
it's one of those things where in the early years, when you are trying to promote the local ecosystem, right, you sort of give legs to that so that they can start running. And I think that's exactly what China, I'm not supporting policy, and I'm by far not at all a policy expert in the world.
In the past, I mean, I think if you go back, I don't know, pre-1950s, maybe my history is not very strong, but I would assume that would be the case, and I think I would agree with you. I don't know, post-2000s or post-1980s, after liberalization, I would assume that countries generally are open to like free trade in general, apart from, agricultural goods where they might place... or like, you know, strategic industries, they might place like, I don't know, very high tariffs, or they may not allow foreign competitors or who are not their allies to compete. But in tech, you don't think it's, because at least in my limited knowledge, I'm not able to find a case as China. Russia comes to mind, but that was a recent, I mean, they've banned Instagram and all recently, but besides China, I'm not able to think of any other country which can.
There are definitely examples historically of countries trying to do something similar, and the idea is to give protect local startups, because in the earlier stages, right, if there are countries that have cheaper goods and things like that, then of course they'll easily sort of supply a lot more, bringing the cost of goods sold, bringing the price down even further, so domestic production will be affected even more. So again, as I said, I'm not supporting either one of the policies. I don't think I'm an expert to make that judgment call. But just, you know, since you asked thoughts about it, I think the China market is a very interesting one. As I said earlier in the podcast, right, that I think that even the China growth story has been very different from the India growth story, even though people compare those two very closely.
Extremely different.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons why we suddenly also saw a lot of the funding happening in India at some point was because they felt like, it'll be, you know, similar to the China story, and maybe I missed out investing in China, so might as well invest in India and get the returns. I think the reason why I say it's different is because at that point when China ecosystem was buzzing, right? I think their own domestic economy was actually very strong, or growing very strong. There was a lot of manufacturing, so that means the middle class was actually strong with a lot of disposable income. So I think that in itself, gave way for a lot of these domestic companies that could become very large and make unit economics work. So I think that for sure was one of the big reasons why I say these two have developed very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there were a lot of these other, small things basically add up a lot. So for example, if you look at the infrastructure in China that they built for, shipping goods from one place to another, or just simply roads.
Amazing,
roads,
right?
Infrastructure.
You're saying amazing.
Yeah. And the reason why that adds up, because for example, the last mile delivery cost here will be super high, or shipping costs will be super high. And again, that basically affects what business models you can truly support, what disposable convenience income you need to have in a family to afford those services and things like that. So all these things, I think, add up a lot. And lastly, I think the way the government supported Chinese startups and enterprises was very different the way in which Indian government was supporting them. I think initially there are, if you just study the China tech ecosystem, right, a lot of the startups were actually funded slash owned by
state, is it?
Owned by the state. And of course now we see another side of it, which is, you know, now that they've become super large, they're trying to, the Chinese government is also more mindful of, hey, the tech ecosystem has become super large and we've forgotten how to focus on like pure innovation, like materials, like climate, like sustainability, semiconductors, everything that, you know, China ecosystem was known for a very long time for. So now they're trying to bounce back to that previous sort of, frame of reference where they truly promote innovation. So I think they basically are very opinionated in terms of what constitutes real growth and what will contribute to growth in the future. Versus the Indian ecosystem, I think for sure, is one that has evolved differently from that perspective.
I had to take a trip to Bombay, I think last month. And I was initially about to take a train, but it's a 20-hour train, 22-hour train. I think the distance is about 600 kilometers. 500 to 600 kilometers. I was so frustrated. I was looking at Chinese infrastructure, and I think they have Beijing to Shanghai. Somebody should fact check me on this, but I think it's about similar. I think 600 kilometers in 4 hours, four and a half hours. They have like trains which are from one city to another. I mean, that is just phenomenal, man. I mean, just imagine taking a train from here at 5 in the morning and reaching Bombay at 10 or 9:30.
Right.
That is like so amazing, and you can come back as well.
To be fair, again, the infrastructure here has also improved extremely significantly. So, for example, case in point, since I've lived for a very long time in Delhi, I would say the infrastructure in Delhi is by a lot of measures better than the infrastructure in San Francisco, the city, not the Bay Area, but the city. With respect to cleanliness, with respect to, you know, public transit and a bunch of other facilities, roads even. I think infrastructure improvements here have also been phenomenal compared to what they were when we were growing up.
Part of the reason I feel it's phenomenal is because, I mean, back then the infrastructure was, I mean, it was abysmal. I mean, you know,
yeah.
So anything is an improvement from what we had before.
Yeah.
I was also, again, I don't want to harp too much on the Chinese, but as much I have a love-hate relation, I hate them. I mean, I don't hate the Chinese, but, you know, in the sense that I was watching one of these driving videos on YouTube where this person just goes on driving around Chinese streets. Oh my God, they are so clean and so well organized and so beautiful. I'm not joking. I cannot think of a single city in India where a street where only billionaires live, maybe that street, maybe, but besides that, I cannot think of a street, a comparable street, where I can say this is like the China of India. You know, I really cannot. I don't know if you can, but I cannot come up with an example. So, and this is not even like a tier one city like Beijing or Shanghai. This is some obscure city.
I've been to Guangzhou, and I've been to both types of streets. Streets that were very organized and clean and nice, and then ones that were, you know, not as clean and nice. So I think what I'm trying to say is, I think there has been a lot of progress, but obviously there's a lot of progress that remains to be seen. As you said, we're basically in a state of the world where manufacturing in India is actually on the rise. Whether you call it because people are trying to depend less on China, whether you can say people are trying to de-risk their supply chains on other countries, whether because India is now actually promoting manufacturing actively, I think there's a lot of progress that is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years.
on the India, I mean, I get the sense that you're very optimistic about the India story. What does the India story mean to you? And what is your hope for India in general, like in the global stage? Do you consider yourself to be very nationalistic? I don't know.
I don't consider myself nationalistic. I consider myself just a good citizen wherever I am. And I think I'm just excited because I think India has, you know, now we're in a place where, I mean, we've always produced founders that have been hungry and hustly. But I think now we've produced, we're producing world-class founders that are hungry, hustly, and can sort of take things to a global level. So how I describe the India story, I think over the next decade or so, we will see lots of great global world-changing companies come out. I actually think that's going to be possible. I think, as I said, you know, multiple times over this podcast itself, we have the right amount of talent, we have the right amount of hunger and ambition, we might now be able to put the pieces in place for it to become an interesting playground. So yeah, I think and maybe it's partly because I deal in SaaS, where in any case things go global. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why I feel so optimistic.
Also, I think your job is on the line. Now, if you don't find good founder, I think you won't be.
I think it's the opposite, actually. I think because I'm optimistic, I'm here. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So
really, okay. So we'll jump around a little bit. I don't want to be chronological. What made you come back from the US to India? What made you
come back? It was mostly to, it was only to start my own venture. I wanted to start up, and I felt like even back then in 2019, when it wasn't obvious, I felt I could take more risk here. I could build a great team and everything else here more easily, more peacefully, at least in the early days. Because of what I was building, maybe I would have had to move back. In any case, I was building a machine learning infrastructure startup. In any case, that would have been global from day zero, the product. So I would have maybe had to move again, but that's fine. I felt like in the early stages, I would prefer to be here versus there.
You were here in the sense in Bangalore?
In India. Bangalore, because it's the technical, like it's the hub. It's the startup hub of India, in my opinion. And plus my co-founders were here, so it made sense for me to be in Bangalore versus anywhere else. I did go back to Delhi, where my parents are still, but I was traveling between Delhi and Bangalore until I moved. But obviously that never happened because COVID happened. So yeah, that's basically how things transpired.
Do you miss the US? I mean, living in the US, or
I mean, for sure you miss things. If you live in a place for 7 years, that definitely becomes home. I still have lots of friends there that I try to meet, you know, once a year when I go back. I miss the fact that I had access to nature a lot more easily. Like, I did not have to depend on anyone. I could just literally, before work, I could drive down to a national park, take a walk, come back. That was all possible. A lot of the fitness stuff that I got into basically was because I was exposed to it over there. And I think people here are still not exposed to it as much as they are over there. So I think I miss a lot of that from the US.
Do you regret coming back?
Absolutely not. I think if you just look at all the stuff I've done, I think I got some of my largest breaks after moving back. And as I said, right, most importantly, the reason why I moved back was to start something of my own. Obviously it's sad that I thought I'd be working on it for 10 years of my life and it ended prematurely, but honestly even that had a lot of lessons, even that had a lot of learnings, and that is the sort of area that I try to make sure I go towards as life goes on, just increasing my learnings.
I watched a few of your presentations, man, as a prep for this anyway. So in one of your presentations, so there was a slide which spoke of one of your tenets in life. I don't know if this is still your tenet in life, but
oh my god, this is 2018, right?
Oh my
product,
god, you're good, man. Your memory is so good. Your history is good, your memory is good. Oh my god, you're a genius. I'm not joking. But so anyways, coming back, your tenets in life, which is live by learning, living by learning. So, what lesson, maybe in your professional or personal life, have you learned in the past year or so? Feel free to go back a few more years, but I would, yeah.
I mean, since last, I'll talk about last 1 year. Since last 1 year has been investing, right? I think the more I learn about investing, the more I learn about just life. And one thing that is totally sinking in is how strong power laws are in life. Strong they are. Power laws. Yeah. How strong they are. What I mean by that is, right from partnering with the one founder or founding team that is super hungry, super hustly in an amazing market, far makes up for 100 other teams that might not be, timing or market that might not be there. So that's one example of the power law. And you know, this actually...
I'm really sorry. You're saying a strong team is much more like...
Strong team plus great market plus everything sort of working out. Like that one sort of sweet spot. I think the what makes great companies is obviously there's the team, but there's also a market. There's also timing. So, and you have to sort of get all three right sometimes.
That's impossible, right?
It's not impossible. There are sometimes that magic happens.
That's the wrong way to phrase it. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's completely out of your control.
It is very rare. It is extremely rare. But that's the thing. That is the sort of, game where you have to sort of wait for that one sort of team or team in combination with market and timing sort of breaking out.
I want to disagree on this in the sense that, I mean, I feel such stories can only be told in retrospect. I mean, there's no way when you're building it.
That is true.
Only once you have $1 billion in your bank account, you can say, this happened, that happened, X connected, Y connected, and then you can weave a story. But
I'm not disagreeing at all that it's super hard to predict on that. It is definitely extremely difficult to predict. All we can do is trust our instincts on people and markets. That's the sort of best you can do. And of course, like, for example, at Lightspeed, right, we're very sort of thesis driven as well. So for example, given a lot of us have an operator background, I can say, cybersecurity is extremely interesting. And I think these 3-4 areas in cybersecurity are super interesting as wedges into the market, etc. So now when I, come across a founding team and they're building something within that, I know immediately that, this is a team that is building an excellent market and sort of a great wedge. And now it's just about founder and spending time with them, getting to know them. And of course, from the other side as well, where they get to know us and they, feel like, okay, we're the best sort of partners they can have. And developing that mutual feeling. But my point to, coming back to what I've learned in the past year, right, is...
I'm so sorry. I want to interject that. In the sense that... just flag that for a second, though, because I keep forgetting things. Which is... we spoke about market timing and, team and all that.
Yeah.
Do you ever sit back and, when you have a strong team, you have a strong company, you have a strong team, a very good idea, good product, all the right things, and still the company goes to shit. I mean, the company fails. Do you ever, sit at a cafe at 11 in the night and wonder, what the hell is happening here? I mean, does that happen to you? Or,
I mean, for sure it can happen, right? As investors, as I said, right, the first thing I said when you asked me the question was, the more I'm learning about investing, the more I'm learning about life. What you do in life is like you try, and of course you think, you try to work smartly. Once you figured out where to work, then after that you work hard within that place. But things can still go bad. Because of so many things not being in your control. I think that's what investing is teaching me, of the number of things that are truly not in your control. But as I said, the right thing for you to do is to... I mean, definitely I feel having that prepared mind is a great weapon. Second, sort of having the right attitude towards learning. Because what truly helps in situations like these, where things are, not everything is in your control, given the dynamic environment and world we live in, things can change within a second. What truly helps is being humble enough to learn from scratch all over again, or reading the signals and then sort of moving in the right direction. So I think those things definitely help. Power law in motion is when some, small sort of, not small, I would say some, small number of decisions or things or people in your life make all the difference.
Mm-hmm. Understood. I mean, No, part of the reason why I asked you that is because, sorry, I mean, on the, you know, things going bad even after Triangle. I mean, I was watching this movie called, there's this Tamil movie called Anbe Sivam. It's a movie by one of my favorite actors, Kamalhasan. This is a huge digression. This is a meaningless digression, but anyways. So in the movie, they save this, there's a kid that meets an accident, and the kid has this very rare blood AB negative or something like that, and they find the blood, and they find this ambulance, and they take him. They're on the way to the hospital. Everything looking good, and still he dies. So the main character is in this. You know, he's asking, you know, is there a God? Because, you know, we did.
Right.
It was already hard to find this blood type, and we found the blood type, and then we found an ambulance, and then we were on the way, and you know, a few more minutes, and he would have been saved. And the main character is like, what is all this? You know, where is the meaning in all this?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I was like, maybe you also have these moments where you're like, I'm investing, where's the meaning in all this? So, yeah. I do a lot of meaningless digressions, yeah, anyways. In December of 2022, OpenAI released ChatGPT to the world. What do you think are the consequences of rapidly advancing AI?
What are the consequences? Now that's a gigantic question, but
really?
I mean, to start with, I'll say that again, it's definitely one of the it's become a very big hype in the US right now. But
have you tried it?
I have not only tried it, I've been playing around with OpenAI modules since 2020.
Okay.
So I was one of the beta users of OpenAI's GPT-3 model when it came out in 2020 during the pandemic. In any case, my startup had died, so I had, you know, time on my hands to play around with things. So generative AI is one of the areas that we're super excited about, and it is definitely an area where just moving a little bit away from all the hype and noise around it, I'll tell you why.
But I'm really sorry. You're saying generative AI, not even narrow.
Generative AI.
I'm so sorry.
No worries. So the reason why I'm saying we're excited about generative AI in general is there are times when you truly are at a point of inflections of these sort of AI actually working. I think in the past, a lot of the modules, and it definitely happened over time, but a lot of the modules were mostly pattern matching, simpler sort of models or just not did not have that performance which would lend itself to productize applications. I think we're finally at that stage of performance where productized applications are possible. We're seeing early, there's definitely a spectrum of it. I think text is one of the more advanced models. So we're seeing applications like, you know, in our own portfolio, we have Pepper Type that helps you build copy for something from website or product that you might have. There are, you know, text is, I think, a slightly more advanced application of it. There are modules in audio that you can build. You can automatically generate content. So, for example, we have Pocket FM as well in our portfolio, which is trying to also build, generate, you know, through generative AI some of the content that they have. Then there are, you know, video applications, which again, still some journey left. But at least what you can do is you can generate some base level of content and then improve upon it. So we have Rephrase, for example, helping with that. And it started a while back on this theme.
On the audio, I had seen some examples where they were able to reproduce a dead man's voice listening to his previous recording. That was
right.
A bit creepy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing, but, pretty you cannot distinguish. I mean, it's that
right.
Insane.
There's literally a score attached to that on when you're able to distinguish that a voice is from a computer-generated one or it's from, you know, a human. So that score has been improving for some of these newer models, such as OpenAI Whisper is one of them. WaveNet is the older one.
The Turing test, I mean, did we... the results, the responses that you get from ChatGPT, I feel like those responses should be indistinguishable to a human,
right.
Sometimes superhuman. I mean, you know, does that mean we've like passed the Turing test? I mean,
so I think a lot of these sort of statements are more to generate hype than a lot of concrete sort of things. But there are, for example, now lots of schools are trying to have a ChatGPT checker. Because obviously students will generate their homework through ChatGPT versus doing it on their own. So there is, we have reached a point where a lot of the content generated by these models is of a certain quality level that it becomes very hard to distinguish, is this from a real person versus ChatGPT, that is there for sure. But I think more important than that is, right, and this is one of the biggest blockers for productizing some of these applications. Some of the negative things about generative AI, for example, in text right now, is one of the problems they suffer is hallucinations. So for example, if I asked, I mean, now obviously it doesn't, they fix that bug or whatever, but in the past, if I, for example, asked them, hey, tell me when the last polar bear went to space, ChatGPT would come up with a beautiful story about how a polar bear went to space, formed a colony on Mars and something else, right? And sound very logical, very
really
sensible.
Generating software.
Yeah. So this is one sort of a big challenge we have right now called hallucinations, where models basically produce good-looking, semantically right content, but something that does not make any sense or is not true. It's just plain and simple false. Then obviously, you know, being able to make sure it performs at a certain reliability and scalability level is a challenge. So, for example, a lot of the models, there's benchmarking around latency. So if you want to, for example, build real-time applications of these models, that is also a challenge. So that's something where people are trying to innovate. Besides that, there are security challenges. So for example, if I base a lot of my security and bias, like the normal thing that, you know, machine learning has been struggling through for a while, those are still somewhat in motion and not completely solved yet. So there are hurdles to productizing and productionizing all of these technologies still. But I think we've been the closest we've ever been to actually doing that. So I think a lot of the, you know, manual automation work in the past that happened through people or through some other intervention, a lot of that can at least till, you know, a reasonable scale be automated and human in the loops can be removed. I think a lot of innovation can happen around content production. To give you an example, right? Movie studios, when they're creating movies, they create like a character set, they create a whole storyboard, and after that, slowly and steadily, like that storyboard gets translated into scenes, then finally a movie comes out. So all of these steps have so much of manual work in terms of people being involved, that sometimes when you have to do a recording, people have to go to a studio, the recording happens, sometimes there are errors, translating things, audio dubbing, audio translating, like that is such a time consuming, money consuming, error prone, resource prone sort of ventures, right? If you could replace all of this by a person sitting on their laptop and maybe running a few tools and automatically translating that or creating like a baseline storyline, for sure it won't be 100%. Maybe it's 70%, maybe it's 90%. Even that reduces your cost basis by like a factor of 10, right? And your time, and saves your time at the same time. So I think a lot of these technologies will be great in some of these content production cases, and really helpful for that. And lastly, I think there are lots of enterprise applications that can come out with ChatGPT. So one theme of applications, for example, we're seeing are developer tools. So people are, GitHub Copilot is an obvious one, but like there are all these other developer assistants that are coming up. You know, there are sales and marketing, lots of sales and marketing tech companies coming up. I think customer support has always been manual. A lot of that can be automated with these technologies. So a lot of enterprise applications can come out, I think.
And they've been pretty amazing, no, at marketing this. I mean, OpenAI, Sam Altman.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, caught fire. I think if you see graphs within 5 days, N million users, X million users.
I saw a tweet where they said it was the fastest app to generate 1 million users or something
like
that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. And I think it's definitely something also, you know, like you get used to that interface very quickly of, you know, just give me an answer. Don't redirect me to links. Don't redirect me to pages. I don't want to do the work of finding out an answer. Just tell me the answer.
I mean, the answers are so good. Not only, I mean, they're just so coherent. I mean, the point-wise, And so I typed in this query, I like someone, and, you know, amazing answer, man. You know, you have to go slowly. My friends would say, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Mental health is an application, by the way, or for generative AI, I think. But like just honestly, one that should be treaded carefully.
Like, just talk to ChatGPT when you're...
And there are multiple things within mental health. There's definitely one. One is an assistant, like a therapist, which I think requires a lot of careful attention given it's therapy. Other things can be, you know, just UGC content generated, like, sorry, ChatGPT, like, content generated automatically for improving your day. There can be affirmations generated, which are also, you know, easier thing to do. So there are many other applications within mental health that can be done, but I think that's another area which is interesting, but one very promising one.
Sure. On that note, thank you for taking the time.
No, thank you so much for coming in and having me here.
All right. The ending is always awkward.